Hello and welcome to this, the seventh in a series of podcasts from Polity. My name is George Miller, and my guest on this programme is Sylvia Walby, who is Professor of Sociology and UNESCO Chair in Gender Relations at Lancaster University. Writing of her work, she has said, "I'm interested in economic change, fascinated by new political forms, for example the European Union, and concerned about marginalised groups, domestic violence matters. These issues are framed by globalisation, the understanding of which requires a use of complexity theory, and human rights, which has become the most important framing of contemporary projects for global justice." I met Sylvia last month to talk about her most recent book, The Future of Feminism. Cynthia Fuchs Epstein of CUNY has called the book extraordinarily erudite and declared it a book for both scholars and activists. Zoe Williams in The Guardian referred to it as magisterial. Feminism is not dead, Sylvia Walby asserts unambiguously on the very first page of the book. She goes on to explore how feminism has changed, delineating where contemporary feminists, self-declared or otherwise, are to be found, what projects they're engaged in, and how they've made common cause with others active in equality and social justice issues. She also assesses feminism's successes and challenges, the threats it faces now, and in an increasingly uncertain future. I started, though, with those pronouncements that feminism is dead and that we are now living in a post-feminist era, still frequently heard in the media. I asked Sylvia if she could see what forces and pressures were at work to create that kind of discourse today.
I think it's changed. I think now people see feminism again. I think there has been an explicit revival in understanding the significance of feminism for the contemporary world. So I agree with you that there was a period when feminism appeared to be quiet and lots of commentators were busy saying that it had gone away. But I think that is now changing. I think one of the reasons why people thought that feminism had gone away was that it had changed form. And instead of being only a form of protest, which was visible and which attempted deliberately to engage with the media, there were engagements with forms of governance, forms of expertise, engaging in lobbying and trying to change things in a systematic and routine way, forms of feminism which are not so visible. And so some commentators who didn't look very far failed to see these new forms of feminism and thus said that it was disappearing. They were always wrong.
So the forms changed, but is there still some discomfort about the appellation feminism itself in culture at large?
There are lots of people who will say, "I'm not a feminist, but..." And then after the "but" follows a series of statements which endorse feminist goals. So there are people like that. But I think it's become increasingly the case that people are prepared to explicitly endorse feminist goals. So I think that is changing.
What do you make of this, what is commonly referred to as raunch culture, which a lot of young women are said to be embracing as a sort of post-feminist reclaiming of their own sexual identity and beyond that, their identity as women? How do you see that fitting in with the kind of forces and issues that you're concerned with?
I think feminists have always raised questions of sexuality and pushing boundaries and barriers and overcoming traditional limitations. So the development of arguments around raunch culture are part and parcel of something that feminism has always done. I think the question is now, what are the new forms of experimentation with sexuality and intimacy, and whether these new forms are ones which take forward the feminist goals? Some of them are indeed merely forms of commercialization and exploitation, while others are experimentations with forms of intimacy which take us further. So I think raunch culture is only one of the forms of experimentation with sexuality and intimacy that we now see. There are lots of other forms, not only raunch culture, and it's the other forms which engage with a more mutual form of engagement, which are the ones which are the way forward for feminist projects.
I mean, am I right in thinking that on your account, raunch culture is really just a sort of incorporation of a certain attitude towards feminism by neoliberal capitalism, as you say, a sort of commercialization of something which one could identify as partly feminist, but in fact it has been sort of co-opted and incorporated?
I don't think feminism has been co-opted and incorporated, but I think there are some practices which have been exploited by neoliberal forces, and some of the commercialized forms of sexuality could be considered in such a way. But the exploitation of sexuality is nothing new. Prostitution, after all, is a form of exploitation of women through sexuality, which has long existed. So I think we shouldn't be overdoing the extent to which sexuality is a form of exploitation of women. It's long been a terrain of struggle. Some practices are positive and other practices are exploitative. I don't think there's any simple statement that sexuality is or isn't a way forward. It is always a terrain of struggle.
One of the chapters in your book looks at the varieties of feminism, because you, as you say, it's changed form, and that's perhaps one of the reasons why some people have claimed that it's disappeared. Can you give me a sort of tour d'horizon of some of the significant variants that you see today?
We've seen feminism enter the state. Once upon a time, it was almost impossible to imagine that we would have feminist ministers, that we would have units which were specialised in promoting gender equality, indeed gender equality alongside other forms of equality. These are quite new, and even in the contemporary era, we see them still within the British state. We see them more strongly perhaps at a European Union level. We see them engaging within at the UN level. So within all sorts of governmental bodies, we now see commitments to certain basic kinds of feminist goals. So that's one of the new areas. It's not always called feminist. Often these issues are quite cautiously progressed, and people are then hesitant about calling these feminist. But the commitment to equal pay has long been a feminist demand. It isn't yet fully realised, and we do now have some commitment to taking forward things in some way. Another example of an area where there have been forms of feminist engagement which aren't usually recognised as feminist is in the trade unions. Again, once it was the case that some trade unions, not all, but some, were closed against women, didn't admit women into membership, restricted entry to certain kinds of jobs. That's now a historical era. Now we see that the trade unions are one of the most important bodies which have been promoting equality, gender equality in the workplace. They're a very important set of organisations taking forward issues of equal pay, equal rights to a promotion, the cessation of harassment at women at work. So today, I would say that trade unions are a major set of feminist organisations. Now, I think that's quite unusual to call them feminist. They're not usually called explicitly feminist, but they're pursuing feminist goals. And so in that way, I would like to call them feminist.
Now, tell me about the notion of the deepening of democracy, because it seemed to me from your book that this was a significant notion, that the depth versus the superficiality of the democracy of a state is of critical value in determining how a feminist agenda may be taken forward, and indeed other socially inclusive projects.
Yes, people often define democracy simply in terms of a state which has elections, sometimes developed so that it's elections which are free and fair with multiple polities, multiple parties. But that's a very superficial understanding of it. The concept of democracy I've been developing, the depth of democracy, involves a much wider range of institutional forms. So, for example, that it's the state, and not other bodies, that govern issues of intimacy. So that it's the state which has control over the regulation of marriage, divorce, sexuality, intimacy. That's one way of thinking about the depth of democracy. Another is in the way in which people are elected. That different electoral systems, for example, whether they're very expensive, how much money does it take to be an effective candidate? Is the electoral system first past the post, or does it have proportional representation? These institutional forms of the electoral system make a very significant difference to who gets elected. And in some places, we have a relatively high proportion of women in parliament, up to 50%. In other places, it's an extremely low percentage. A democracy is deeper if it has people participating in it. And if, for example, the parliament itself has a higher portion as a representative set of people elected. So that's another example. It's a second way of thinking about the depth of democracy. And the final area that I was looking at was over the extent to which the democratic principle is extended to the governance of a whole series of institutions of our lives. So if education and health are governed democratically because they're part of the public sector, then that's part of the depth of democracy. And if they're privatised, then they are taken out of the democratic arena and our democracy is made more shallow. So I have a list of 10 points which I've summarised here, all of which contain the depth of democracy, and that the depth of democracy has significant implications for people's lives.
By way of generalisation, it would be fair to say that the more neoliberal the policies a country pursues, the more shallow the depth of democracy, versus the more socially democratic a country is, where the depth of democracy tends to be greater. So if it were on a spectrum, there would be a sort of correlation between those attributes.
The depth of democracy affects all sorts of things about a country. And the deeper the democracy, the more likely it is to be social democratic rather than neoliberal, yes.
And that is played out in all sorts of social issues, among which are equality issues, women's rights and so on.
Yes, democracy affects everything. So a democratic state will typically regulate employment so as to ensure both justice and effectiveness. It would regulate the financial sector so that it is subordinate to the real economy rather than ruining the real economy. It would mean the regulation of violence, the regulation of men's violence against women, the regulation of conflicts so that they don't become war. Democracy has effects across the whole of the economy, polity, violence and civil society, yes.
Now, you raised there the issue of violence against women as one of those areas which is affected. At what level do you think intervention action against violence against women is most fruitfully pursued? Because there are sort of transnational efforts, human rights efforts, there are national efforts, local efforts, and I suppose combinations of all of those. But is it possible to try to summarise where you think pressure and activism is most fruitfully exercised?
I think the movement against men's violence against women has been very effective as a consequence of being engaged at all of those levels. We've seen the grassroots movements and protests. We've seen the establishment of very specific institutions to help the women who've suffered the violence. So, for example, refuges where women can go, or rape crisis lines where people can phone. We've seen the development of these very specific institutions. We then saw the lobbying of the state so that these institutions could be better funded, and that engaged quite systematically with the way that the state addressed these issues. We saw the change in legislation as a result of the lobbying efforts, which meant that more things became criminalised than previously were. For example, it wasn't until 1994 that rape within marriage became a criminal offence. We've seen changes in policing as a result of the pressures. We've seen economic assistance to women who have suffered violence. So I think the efforts have taken place across a whole series of domains, both grassroots, feminist institutions, engaging with the state, and that there is now also an international level to that. It's become a global movement. It's invoked the UN. Even the UN now has a campaign against violence against women. The UN typically will articulate its concerns via a discourse of human rights, seeing violence against women as a violation of women's human rights, and that itself has helped to mobilise at a global level against these forms of violence. So I wouldn't want to pick out one particular part of that and say that was the one thing to do, but rather it's been the engagement at these multiple levels and across countries which has been effective in reducing, but absolutely not yet eliminating, the violence.
I mean, you talked there about protective measures for women, and you talked about criminalisation measures. I wondered what you thought was most effective when it comes to changing attitudes. And clearly they are changing, but they've not nearly gone far enough. So I suppose I'm thinking about the attitudes of men towards the acceptability or the non-acceptability of violence against women. What do you think exerts most pressure on those sometimes cultural attitudes?
I think changes in institutional practice have been the most effective ways of changing attitudes. So when all the institutions that are relevant changed their policies, then all of the people working in those institutions had to understand the implications of that. So, for example, when the police were told that they had to change practices, so they had to record these offences, they had to arrest the perpetrators, then that would change the attitudes of the serving police officers. So I think that happens in general, that we should think of the change in the institutional locations where attitudes are formed, and then we will see the attitudes follow on. I don't think simply intervening at a cultural level is the most effective way to go.
Now, one of the other, I thought, interesting analytical tools or categories you used was that of the gender regime, contrasting the domestic versus the public. Maybe I can get you to explain a little bit about what is understood by that and how you use that as an analytical tool.
By gender regime, I mean a system of gender relations, by which I mean that all different aspects of gender relations are interconnected. You can't just separate one part out and deal with that. They all matter. You can't address violence against women without addressing practices in civil society, practices in the state, and indeed the economic structure. If you were to reduce gender inequality, it would require changes in each of those four institutional domains. So the basic concept is of the interconnection between different aspects of gender relations. After that, I want to make distinctions between different kinds of gender regimes. One of the distinctions is the one that you've already mentioned between neoliberal and social democratic forms of gender regimes. In social democratic forms of gender regimes, there is less inequality, there is a greater depth of democracy, and typically less violence against women. In the more neoliberal forms of gender regime, we'll have a more shallow form of democracy, greater economic inequality, and higher rates of violence. So those are the contemporary modern forms of the gender regime. But we've also seen changes from a pre-modern form to a more modern forms of gender regime, pre-modern forms usually meaning that women were more domesticated and weren't so much involved in the public domain. We've seen a major change to the more modern forms of gender regime with women involved in the public. But I think one of the questions today is, what is the form of that public gender regime and how unequal is that gender regime? And there are alternative futures here.
And I suppose the question is, how do gender regimes change? What levers can be pressed in order to effect change? And I'm sure you'll say it's complicated and it's multifaceted, but maybe I can ask you to attempt to sort of summarise that.
Feminism is obviously one of the major sources of change in forms of gender relations. Feminism, I think, is a very broad social movement, a very broad set of civil society practices, which can have potentially major effects on the nature of gender relations and on the gender regime. So that would be one place I would start. But changes in the gender regime are also affected by changes in the wider economy. They're affected by changes in other forms of inequality. If other forms of inequality increase, then that has implications for the gender regime. So gender cannot be seen in isolation. It has to be analysed in its intersections with other forms of inequality.
We spoke a little bit earlier about feminism and the trade union movement, and that's clearly an example of feminists making common cause with other activists. And clearly there are other arenas in which feminism will make common cause. It might be anti-racism, it might be human rights, it might be environmentalism. Is it in fact a danger, or is that a natural evolution and development? To what extent should we be worried if something is braided together with feminism, or to what extent is that actually a useful political strategy in order to achieve a wider aim?
I think that's one of the major dilemmas facing feminism. If we name it as feminism, then we are typically making arguments around a very specific set of issues. But in order to change things, in order for the changes in the gender regime to take place, it's necessary for there to be these engagements with other political projects. And at the same time as that engagement, then that will usually mean that feminism has a lower profile within that engagement. The projects will typically have more general terms to describe them, and there will be a loss of the visibility of feminism. I think that's one of the key dilemmas in feminist politics. Since it's a major dilemma, there's no easy answer to it. I think that's something that has to be addressed systematically on a case-by-case basis.
And I suppose if first wave feminism is seeking recognition and we've gone beyond that, we've also gone beyond a sort of essentialist phase. That was one of the lessons I took from your book, that back then, back in the 60s and 70s, it was probably politically expedient to think about woman and feminism as fairly discrete, well-contained, well-defined categories. But we've moved into a political environment where that is no longer either effective or really acceptable.
The accusation of essentialism, which has been levelled at feminism, is rarely justified. Most feminist projects have engaged with adjacent groups and the intersection of gender inequality with other forms of inequalities. So even back in the 60s, when most people would say feminism was essentialist, there were engagements with other projects. There was an anti-war movement. Feminists were part of that. Some trade unions have always supported feminist goals. In fact, in the 1970s, we think of the equal pay strikes as being an alliance between feminism and trade unionists. So I'm not sure that the allegation that feminism was only concerned with identity and was essentialist was ever really a fair criticism of the breadth of the movement. But there is a dilemma there, because we do want to be able to say that there are some specific feminist goals which can be lost if you get too swept up with a general project and lose the specificity of the issues. And I think that's an ongoing dilemma which will always be there. There will always be a tension between the need to both separately identify the feminist goals and also to engage with the other projects which are engaged with justice concerns. I don't think there's an answer. I think it's a constant tension which must always be addressed.
What do you think the financial crisis of 2008 and its ongoing consequences means for the achievement of feminist goals? Has it set them back? Has it made it more difficult? Or has it perhaps in some ways opened up new possibilities?
The financial crisis, which was generated by neoliberalism and the lack of regulation of the financial sector, is a major problem not only for feminists but for every other justice project. It led to not only an immediate recession, but is leading to much longer term recessions. It's threatening the stability of states, with the sovereign debt defaults threatened in Southern Europe and in other countries. It's led to serious political difficulties for the European Union. And the European Union is so important for gender equality policy in all of its member states that the way that the financial crisis has threatened the European Union is a challenge to feminism and to feminist goals in a wider European context. We're potentially at a tipping point. If the European Union were to be able to reform, to be strong enough politically to withstand the challenges of finance, then potentially it would be a stronger European Union in which there would be support for the equality policies. But if, as most people fear at the moment, the financial crisis will lead to the major disruption of the European Union and its capacity for action, then we potentially see the undermining of some of the strong equality legislation which derived from the European Union. So the financial crisis has effects on feminism and on feminist goals, both very directly in terms of the economic inequalities and poverty which follows from the recessions, but it also has these effects, far its political effects, upon major institutions such as the European Union.
And what about the other great, even greater contemporary issue, which is climate change? What role do you see for feminism in addressing climate change issues?
Climate change is another major problem, a major crisis. The world is not only warming, but heating. We are likely to see consequences of that, not only in extreme weather events, but in the loss of capacity to generate food, and then struggles over scarce resources are more likely to lead to violent confrontations. So the environmental crisis is a very serious one for everybody on the planet. One of the ways in which it connects with feminist projects is over a shared analysis of the root causes of the environmental crisis. That is, a shared analysis of the problems of an unregulated capital. In both cases, both for feminism and for environmental crisis, that is a real problem that we haven't been able to sufficiently regulate the ways that the economy has developed to ensure that this takes place in a way which is sustainable and just. So the greater effective social democratic regulation of the economy could have benefits both directly in terms of the effects on climate change as well as for its effects on gender inequality. The two projects, I think, significantly overlap. If one falls, both fall. And if both are supported, then both can support each other very strongly.
If you'd been asked 20 years ago to imagine where the feminist agenda would have reached by 2011, do you think your guesses would have been in any way accurate?
20 years ago, 1990, I wrote Theorizing Patriarchy. And in that book, I was looking at the change in the form of patriarchy or gender regime, which is effectively the same thing, from a private to a public form. I think that has developed in approximately the way we had anticipated, with the increase of women in employment, increase of women in education. Perhaps the increase of women in politics has been more disappointing, not quite as far on as it might have been anticipated to go. I think we didn't see the rise of neoliberalism. We didn't anticipate 20 years ago that we would be seeing the intensification of inequalities. We didn't imagine that we would be having so many wars. And we didn't anticipate struggles over oil and other resources. So the rise of inequality was something which was not expected. And I think that makes us much more pessimistic now than it did 20 years ago.
And maybe, Sylvia, I can ask you, in conclusion, you head one of the final sections of your book, Promising Start, Major Challenges Ahead. With what degree of optimism do you think we're progressing towards meeting those challenges?
Feminism is now much more powerful than it ever was. It's much more developed, it's much more sophisticated, it's much more effective, and it's much more widely spread. That's the hope. The challenges are much greater. The rise of neoliberalism, the extent of warfare, financial crisis, the environmental crisis are all much greater challenges than we once might have imagined. In order to rise to those challenges, it's essential that there are effective alliances with other justice movements around issues of climate change, inequality, class issues, racism. They're all important projects, and if there were to be effective alliances, then that gives rise for optimism. If there are not, then the conclusion is a very pessimistic one, that the rise of neoliberalism will destroy us all.
Sylvia Walby. The book we were discussing, The Future of Feminism, is available now in both paperback and hardback. You'll find full details about it on the Polity website at politybooks.com. I hope you'll join me again soon for another Polity podcast, and until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.